Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Charlotte Littlefield is off tonight. We're going to be speaking tonight about the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear disaster. It occurred exactly 6 years ago on March 11th, 2011. And it was just, it's ongoing. We know now the Japanese government, along with the American government, covered it up. It was a result, the disaster was a result of the Kahuku earthquake, which happened on that day, 11th of March, 2011. And it put out a tsunami that swept towards the east coast of Japan and caused major damage. When this earthquake first struck, what we had occur was a shutdown of these four nuclear generating plants at Fukushima. And then what kicked in, because there was power out to the project itself, what kicked in immediately was diesel generators. But the problem with the diesel generators continuing the water circulation, what happened was in a nuclear meltdown situation, if you don't keep water circulating through that core becomes very, very hot and begins to melt down and take it through the containment vessel and containment building and so forth. And that's actually what occurred to three out of the four reactors that were active at the time. Fukushima Daiichi actually consisted of six reactors and power generators, but two were inactive and already closed down when the disaster struck on March 11, 2011. So there were four up and running. One they managed to close down before disaster struck, but reactor 1, 2, and 3 went into meltdown within 24 to 48 hours. And there were explosions that occurred because of hydrogen gas collecting in some of the buildings and so forth. And it was just a major, major event. I always thought when I looked at this, and I was watching it live most of the time because we were so focused in on it. But I will say this, when this occurred, we immediately got on the line, Charlotte Littlefield and I did, and arranged an interview with the Tsunami Warning Center in Honolulu, Hawaii. And we actually interviewed the director. We have up on our site tonight these interviews and so forth, and we have multiple click-offs. We must have 6 or 8 or 10 different click-offs that you can go into to get additional information about the Fukushima nuclear disaster. But anyway, Charlotte Littlefield and I were immediately on the line to Hawaii. We were interviewing the tsunami director of the tsunami warning. And by the time that tsunami, the major impact, the earthquake was northeast of the main island of Japan, and right directly to the west is where most of the major damage occurred. Even though the tsunami was put out along the coast, so there were many villages that were fronting on the east coast there onto the Pacific that had major waves come in, 50, 60, 70 foot waves come in and just take out buildings and everything. It was just a total disaster. But getting back to the Fukushima location, which was southwest of the actual epicenter of the earthquake, when that wave hit Fukushima, this was about 30 minutes after they had lost power, but the Fukushima complex managed to get the diesel generators kicked in. But the problem with the diesel generators in this situation was they were in the basement of those buildings. So when the Fukushima wave came in, it swept over the seawall and went down and flooded the basements and knocked out the diesel generators. Well, when the diesel generators were knocked out, then the water circulation quit, and that's when the process of meltdown started. It took between 24 to 48 hours, or a little longer, for three of those plants to melt down. Now, when a mass of radiation, radioactive material, that's been used for heating water and to boiling for running generators. When it goes into meltdown, it becomes what scientists refer to as a corium mass, okay? And a corium mass is just an amalgamation of melted radioactive material that becomes 5,000 degrees centigrade, and it can start melting down through the floor. It can just melt through about anything. Well, three of those started melting down, and today authorities cannot tell us where those three masses are or how deep they are in there. Now, the problem with this thing, this disaster, is that initially, before they even built the plant, they had to do an EPA type of survey of that site, the equivalent of what would be Environmental Protection Agency here. But it was a Japan, of course, EPA type of feasibility. And there happens to be, and still is, there are springs coming down this hillside. This was built on a hillside, so there was a cut made at a certain distance above sea level. And then that plant was built. Well, coming underneath that plant are springs, okay? So the danger is approaching that when those core masses, those corium is what they defined as, start melting down and start interacting with the seawater coming in from the east or the springs coming down from the west there underneath the hillside and then start vaporizing all that water, and anything could happen. So we know this hasn't happened yet, but there are extremely dangerous levels of radiation. 100 rems of radiation on the scale of measurement equals 1 sievert, okay? Now, NASA, for years in their astronaut program, has monitored all their astronauts so that they don't get overexposed to radiation, whether they're up in space or here. So their maximum exposure was 1 sievert per career, which would be 20 years or more for their careers. They recently measured in the last few months radiation at reactor number 2 of 650 sieverts per hour. Now, we're talking about NASA having a guidelines of 1 sievert per 20-year period, not per hour. So the radiation there is very dangerous. They put a robot in there. It melted the camera and some of the electronics of the robot. The radiation level was so high. Now, what happens long term, as I understand from nuclear engineers, is that radiation over a long period of time will make metal objects more fragile and weaken those. And so that's basically what it did to that robot in a matter of just a few hours and made it unusable and just, you know, crap, you know, junk, you know. Now getting back to what's going on today is that on this first hour, this is introduction to Helen Caldicott's presentation to us that occurred on May 12th, 2012. And towards the end of that interview, she says that they've covered this thing up. And this was 2012, okay? They started a little over a year into it. They started covering this thing up from the get-go, okay? TEPCO, which was the owner of the Daiichi plant, the Fukushima Daiichi plant, where they had these 6 reactors, 4 were active at the time of this disaster, was building 2 more nuclear reactors at Bay City in Texas. Now, after this thing blew up and everything, then they canceled that, okay? But there were 2 additional reactors that were being planned for Bay City, Texas, by this same company. Now, what they found recently is extremely dangerous radiation where no one could go in there and work at all. So that's where we're at this point of the juncture. And Stephen Starr, I interviewed him by telephone recently. We're going to have that available on our site. So Stephen Starr is a radiation nuclear weapons expert out of Missouri, University of Missouri. We just didn't have the space to put it up on our air broadcast this weekend. But you can go in there, and there's about a 27-minute interview, quick, short interview I had with him. And cesium-137 is found throughout the world now in the oceans. It's been a total disaster. You've since March 11, 2011, radiation out of those three meltdown reactors has been spewing forth continuously, has not stopped, into the Pacific. We have the North Pacific that's a disaster. Much of the marine life is dead. We have the British Columbia coast that has many problems in the lagoons and so forth. If you go in there, Dana Dunford, one of our colleagues in these endeavors for truth, he actually was interviewed on our Fukushima 2 conference that we held here in Austin, and that was in 2014. I was so concerned that I held one at the three-year anniversary here in Austin at the University of Texas. And then I held one about 6 months later because I was so worried about Fukushima. But we did not get any cooperation from the University of Texas, the Daily Texan, or the KLBJ. I approached them and all the media here in Austin. They would not give me the time of day. And this is a major, major disaster, and it's becoming a kill event, according to some people. Now, the Japanese-American community in Austin did not support this either. And everyone believed the Japanese government, which was lying, and they also believed the American government, which they, too, were in concert with the Japanese government, and they were totally lying and covering up the real danger of Fukushima Daiichi. Now, Daiichi means primary or one, number one. There was a second plant north of Fukushima Daiichi, which also had problems, but they were able to shut down in time to avoid a major disaster there. In the meantime, they are planning to move people back into the general area where Fukushima is, which is totally dangerous to even live anywhere close. And right now, if a major earthquake occurred close to Fukushima Daiichi and toppled some of the buildings, and they are storing plutonium on this site also. If a major earthquake occurred offshore close to Fukushima and disrupted those buildings and brought those buildings down, it could be a major, major disaster for Tokyo. When these three nuclear reactors started melting down, there was plutonium plumes put out, okay? And some of that was blown. Initially, it went out to sea. The USS Ronald Reagan aircraft carrier was offshore there. And Steve Simmons got contaminated along with about 80 or 90 to 100 other sailors that were on duty and that were on board that ship. Now, Steve Simmons came to our Fukushima second. We flew him in and put him up with a nice hotel room, and came in and testified to his experience on board the USS Ronald Reagan. But now the government is fighting those sailors and not providing them any help or anything for the damage that was caused to their health. And Steve Simmons is in a wheelchair. So those are some of the things in the background that the government has been hiding. They've been pulling back from the initial studies they had on the West Coast. They have been hiding and lying all the time about Fukushima. Now, we do have these radiation readings that are just recent. And we have Helen Caldicott had written a book in the meantime called Crisis Without End. Many people are beginning to describe this as a kill event. And that means that this could take down the world, see. There's so much radiation there, and it's three reactors. It doesn't even compare to the Chernobyl accident in north central Ukraine. The Chernobyl was finally, they covered it over with a big concrete sarcophagus and built a building over it. But that was only good to keep it from spreading out any further than it did. It did not diminish the radiation exposure to the local close-in people. And they, of course, there's exclusion zones in there too, because it's even dangerous to get too close to the Chernobyl reactor now that melted down years ago. But these three meltdowns in Tokyo or Cloudside, actually, let me describe this. Tokyo in relationship and locational relationship to Fukushima is about 120 miles to the south-southwest from Fukushima. You have the prevailing winds that are either going north-east or they're coming southwest. So if getting back to this, what I said earlier, if there is a major problem with Fukushima Daiichi and radiation was put up into the air like plumes of plutonium, which has occurred before, and the prevailing winds were to the southwest, it would take it directly over Tokyo. Now, Tokyo and Yokohama today is the most densely occupied place in the world. I can't say densely. It's one of the highest populated areas in the world. There's approximately 35 million people living in the Tokyo-Yokohama area. So it would be a major, major catastrophe. What we're looking at now is to try to help provide and continue helpful ways to ward off any future radiation. As this radiation continues to spew forth out to the Pacific currents are from the west to the east towards Canada, and then it sweeps down along the California coast and then goes back to the west, back into the Pacific. But there are prevailing winds that come across with a jet stream from the west to the east that can bring other things if it gets into the air. Right now, we've got the radiation getting into the water primarily. There's not, you know, as much in the air like there was during the initial disaster when they melted down and blew up and had hydrogen blow up and everything else. So right now, that's what we're concerned about. Now, the last part of this first hour will be that interview that Charlotte Littlefield and I had with Helen Caldicott. Now, the second hour is John Apsley, Dr. John Apsley. He's written a book on Fukushima several years ago. But what he's saying back then is still applicable today. And also, he's a doctor that specializes in cancer and alternative cancer cures, along with a Dr. Hines out of West Texas. So that's very important to look at. We also have a click off in there of some of the videos that we did during Fukushima 2 here in Austin, Texas, and that would be in March of 2014. And we did some additional videos in the Fukushima 2 that occurred later on that year. We do have click offs also on Caldicott, Dr. Helen Caldicott's seminar and symposium that was held in New York at the two-year anniversary juncture. So we have that for you to review at your time. And that was excellent with many doctors throughout the United States. And there were some world-renowned specialists. And there's one pediatrician, I forget his name, but he really knows the problem with children. The problem with children when it comes to radiation is they're much smaller than the average adult. So what we have with children is an additional hazard and risk to their health because they're smaller in size, see? And so children are much more vulnerable to the same amount of radiation than an adult. And they're also growing. Children are multiplying and adding more cells to their body. We're replenishing cells that are dying, adults are, and then the older people are losing cells. And that's the death process. But young children are not only replacing existing cells that are dying, but adding to and growing, see, in size. And so that is a double risk when you have ionized radiation exposure to small children, see. So anyway, we want you to enjoy listening to this. This is serious stuff. It's not enjoyable exactly to listen to this truth, see. The truth can be very, 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 very sad at times. And we're just calling on, hey, Japanese Americans, get off your duff, get off your sofa, and get out here and help us get well and keep America well. They did nothing of any help for us here in the Austin area. So I'm calling on that. That's a challenge. And my big challenge right now is to Ron Paul, Rand Paul, and President Trump. let's call for an international conference on Fukushima. And at minimum, at least we can start employing more helpful ways to ward off any future radiation effect of the Americans here, and especially on the West Coast. The West Coast is suffering a deadly dose of radiation each and every day, and they're covering it up, and they just don't want to tell the public the truth about it. But anyway, come in to thesecrettruth.com. We broadcast from Austin, Texas, air broadcast. We've been broadcasting over 10 years. And this program tonight is not the most enjoyable program to listen to. It's something, though, that's very, very important for every American and for the world. And that's why I'm calling for an international conference to be held to try to address somewhat, as well as we can at this juncture, the problems, the ensuing problems of Fukushima Daiichi. We want to thank all of our people, our listening audience, that have been very, very supportive over the years, and that have helped us and encouraged us to continue to broadcast. I'm just sorry that tonight this isn't the most wonderful program to listen to, but it's something that we must continue to address. So thank you very much for listening to this. In just a few moments, we've got Helen Caldicott coming up on a replay. The second hour is Dr. John Apsley. He's out of the Seattle area. And we want to thank you very much for listening to our program. And we certainly appreciate your support. And God bless everybody out there.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm Charles Butler, along with my co-host,
Charlotte Littlefield.
Well, I tell you what, Charlotte, this next lady is an international wonderful lady. She's been working against a lot of this nuclear hazardous, you know what I mean, bombs and devices and power, you know, sources and so forth for years, for decades, over 37 years. Her name is Dr. Helen Caldicott, the single most articulate and passionate advocate of citizen action to remedy the nuclear and environmental crises. Dr. Helen Caldicott has devoted over 38 years to an international campaign to educate the public about the medical hazards of the nuclear age and the necessary changes in human behavior to stop environmental destruction. In addition, one of her umbrella groups, the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1985. I can go on and on, but welcome to our program, and we are honored to have you, Dr. Helen Caldicott.
Thank you.
Well, I tell you what, you've been up against some really frustrating times. Is that true?
Oh, yes, for 41 years, trying to battle the nuclear power and weapons industry. They must be the toughest critters on Earth, I think.
I noticed in some of your presentations, your tone and some of your words, words were very frustrating. And you've been at this for, what, 38 years plus. And when you first started, was there much more enthusiasm for this anti-nuclear, industry or what?
Well, I started work in 1971, actually, and I was a very young doctor, and I was driven to write a letter to the local newspaper because France had come down to the Pacific Ocean and was testing nuclear weapons in the atmosphere. And in Adelaide, the town where I lived, we were getting a very high fallout in the water, which was concentrating in the milk. And strontium 90 was probably getting into children's teeth and bones. And I wrote a letter saying that these children could develop leukemia and or cancer. And the letter was published. And every time the French blew up another bomb, I was on television talking about fallout and radiation and cancer, which I knew a lot about.
So you got your start in that early 71 period.
That's correct, yes. And 75% of Australians rose up against the French and demanded that the French stop blowing up bombs in the atmosphere, and we took France to the International Court of Justice, and she was forced to test underground. So it was a victory, really, by just purely by education.
What is the status right now of the movement, in your own words? How would you describe what's going on right now in this world, and especially after this Fukushima disaster, which is, it has a world impact and threat to the whole world, does it not?
Oh, Fukushima is a terrible tragedy, not just for the Japanese people, but for the Northern Hemisphere. And the accident is not over, and it's very tenuous. In fact, if there's another earthquake there, a large one, Building 4 could collapse, and there would be a huge release of radiation such that Tokyo would need to be evacuated, and that's 39 million people, and the radiation would come over and land all over the United States, and people would later be developing cancer and leukemia, and it takes about 5 to 70 years for those diseases to develop once you've inhaled or eaten radioactive food. So it's a disaster waiting to happen, and I do not see the governments of the world or the United Nations doing anything about this at all. It's quite an extraordinary situation.
We have, Charlotte and I have taken an initiative to have a Fukushima Solutions Conference here in Austin, Texas, hopefully mid-July, and we would certainly love for you to be a part of that.
Well, I live in Australia. You'll have to fly me over.
Right, we'll do that. Sure, we'll fly you over first class, because
okay.
You're a first-class lady and a battler. You're a first-class lady and a battler and activist against what has now become, with Fukushima, a death wish almost for the world.
Not the whole world. You see, the two air masses of the northern and southern hemisphere don't mix at the equator, so you get the fallout. Down in Australia, it won't affect us, except that huge amounts of radioactive materials have been put into the sea in the Pacific Ocean, and the currents go north to south, and the fish swim all over the place, so we'll be impacted by that.
Right. Go ahead, Sean.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to meet you. I've watched a lot of your presentations on the Internet, on some colleges, and some on YouTube. You talk about over 200 types of radioactive isotopes and all having various, shelf lives, if you were. A lot of people will say, well, you get radiation from the sun. What would you say to the critics and to the advocates for nuclear energy to claim that those 200-plus type isotopes are the same as the radiation we get from the sun?
I speak as a physician, and it's well known medically that all radiation is dangerous. It's estimated that 30% of the cancers we see are induced by background radiation from the sun and from radon that comes from rocks on the earth and the like. Radiation is cumulative. Each dose you get adds to your risk of getting cancer. No radiation is safe. You mustn't walk through those X-ray machines at the airport. You must not. Fetuses are thousands of times more sensitive to radiation than adults. Children 20 times more so, and little girls are twice as sensitive as little boys. We don't know why. So to say that, well, we're just exposed to background radiation, so it's all fine, it's not fine at all. Radiation causes mutations which cause genetic diseases like cystic fibrosis, diabetes, and others that are passed on down the generations, and it causes cancer and leukemia. That's just a fact of life, and they are lying when they say things like that.
Yeah, so we've laid waste, as you've said. I've been very concerned about the depleted uranium in the Middle East. What would be your comments about Iraq, Afghanistan, etc.?
Well, the American military found that uranium-238, which is a waste product from nuclear power and weapons production, is 1.7 times more dense than lead, and so it makes terrific anti-tank shells. It penetrates the armor of a tank like a hot knife through butter. But when the uranium shell hits the tank, it burns. It's pyrophoric, and up to 80% of it burns, producing tiny little particles that can be inhaled into the lung. America used 360 tons of this ammunition in Basra in the first Gulf invasion. They've used it in Baghdad, where half the population of 5 million is children, and they used a hell of a lot of it in Fallujah. In Fallujah, the incidence of severe congenital anomalies, like babies being born with no brains or single eyes or no arms and the like is so high, it's about 25% of births now, that the doctors have told the mothers to stop having babies. The trouble is that uranium-238 lasts for billions of years, billions. And the incidence of childhood cancer is extremely high, and because of the sanctions, the doctors can't get the drugs to treat their childhood patients. So America's conducting, in effect, a nuclear war in Iraq. They're using this ammunition too in Afghanistan. They used it in Bosnia. They're selling it all over the world. And I went to the factory the other day in Tennessee.
Hold that thought, and we'll get back to Tennessee. We've got to take a break.
We've got to cut out. We'll be right back. Thank you.
America's number one source for independent talk radio for...
Welcome back to the Secret Suit. I'm George Butler, along with my co-host,
Charlotte Littlefield, and a warm welcome back to Dr. Helen Caldicott, who's joining us all the way from Australia. Is that correct, Dr. Caldicott?
Yes, I'm in a little fishing village south of Sydney.
Oh, wonderful. Well, you were speaking about your visit to the United States, Tennessee, some sort of manufacturing facility.
Yes, the facility is called Aerojet, and it was like standing outside, like watching a factory producing the gas ovens that Hitler made during the war to kill the Jews and the homosexuals and the others, you know, the mentally retarded. It was the most extraordinary experience, knowing that factory is producing weapons that are creating the most ghastly birth deformities and cancer in children, and will do so for the rest of time, because you see, they're contaminating the cradle of civilization between the Tigris and Euphrates River in Iraq, where civilization began. That's where writing began and the law began and arithmetic and mathematics. It's just an extraordinary thing. And you know, there's been virtually no publicity about this in America. And indeed, I wrote an article for the New York Times about it, probably 8 or 9 years ago, and they refused to publish it. It was a straight medical article. So why would the New York Times refuse to publish something like that? What is the cover-up? Why is there a cover-up?
Well, I'm afraid that our senators are very much controlled by General Electric and some of these mega corporations, Halliburton, et cetera, not to pick on General Electric or Halliburton. But unfortunately, the United States Congress and Senate do not respond to the people anymore. They're bought and sold and paid for by these global corporate warmongering corporations.
Yes, I know. I actually, when I spoke at an Occupy demonstration outside the EPA the other day in Washington, I called them corporate prostitutes, and they really are, except, you know, maybe Bernie Sanders from Vermont, who's a wonderful, magnificent man. But you see, the thing about America is that most people don't vote, and I don't understand that, because in Australia, voting is compulsory. We get fined $50 if we don't vote. We consider it a privilege to live in a democracy. And I tell people in America, if you don't vote, go and live in Yemen, because if you live in a democracy, you have a responsibility, and voting should be compulsory. But more than that, once you've voted, if you don't get to know your Congress representatives, congressional, and your senators, and go and see them every time they come home to their district, like once a week. They're always there. And educate them and say, if you don't do this, this, and this, and if you don't read this book or take doctors with you and teach them, then you leave a vacuum into which step the corporation. So it really is in the hands of the people. The people are the leaders, and the people in Congress are your representatives. The president is not your leader. You are his leaders, you know? And people don't understand that. So I think the Occupy movement is the first time I've seen people get off their couches and off their chairs in front of their computers and go and do something really positive. I think the movement in Wisconsin has been very powerful, you know, trying to take back their country from that dreadful Governor Walker, who's been recalled, and is being funded by the Koch brothers and others. So there's a way to, you know, to establish a democracy in America, but it will take some effort and energy, but it's very important, because the earth is in the intensive care unit and it's acutely sick. You know, it's actually dying at the moment.
Well, you know, Doctor, we've got, you know, we're talking about corruption here, but it's far deeper than I ever imagined it. We started broadcasting 5.5 years ago. Charlotte and I started out with corrupt elections and electioneering fraud. That was our first program 5.5 years ago.
Election theft.
You know, we can, people can be responsible and get out and vote, but that vote sometimes is turned into whoever, you know, manipulates the election into their advantage.
I know that we've got to get out there and take over the Congress. You know, the Congress belongs to the people. The people pay for it. It's their building. They've got to take over the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and occupy that, like the people occupied the State House in Wisconsin for, you know, months, right through the winter. And so it actually takes commitment, responsibility, the sort of thing that I would compare to a doctor when I'm on duty at night and I've got a patient in the intensive care unit. I stay up all night with that patient. That's the dedication that we have in medicine, and we have to use that dedication now to save the planet. And it's America that has to decide whether or not the Earth lives or dies. It really is.
Well, what do you think our ramifications are for the Fukushima, Japan nuclear disasters? I know that you went and studied Chernobyl and Three Mile Island in great detail. What is your prognosis for the United States? I do mean like the Midwest, not just the western coast, but how far in is this radiation going to penetrate?
The ambient levels of radiation in Seattle after the accident went up 40,000 times above normal. And the seaweed off the coast of California and Anaheim, where Disneyland is, the levels of radioactive iodine in the kelp were extremely high, and that came from fallout that fell down with rain. And radiation fell all over your country. The EPA stopped testing the air to see if you're getting radiation. They're not testing the fish that are caught in the Pacific on the West Coast. They're not testing the water. To their discredit, I must say. And if Building 4 collapses because it's very fragile and on top is a fuel pool with spent fuel which has 10 times more radiation in it really than what was released at Chernobyl, if that building collapses with an earthquake greater than 7 on a seismic scale, then you are going to get a hell of a fallout. You know, if that happens, I'm thinking of evacuating my family from Boston because I've got two little grandchildren there and they're terribly sensitive to radiation. So, and no one seems to be, it's as if everyone's like those monkeys, can't see, can't hear, can't speak, that they're practicing psychic numbing like lemmings rushing towards the cliff. I absolutely do not understand the psychology except that there's a huge push to protect the nuclear industry. And they're spending hundreds of millions of dollars on propaganda, you know, and there's a huge cover-up.
Absolutely. In fact, right now I signed a petition to stop the Congress or the government from guaranteeing the nuclear industry's loans for the construction of new nuclear facilities. I don't think the government should be guaranteeing any loans in the nuclear field, period.
So
in fact, I don't think they should be building new reactors. I think they need to be planning to shut them down.
Mining uranium, you pay for the enrichment of the uranium, you pay for the building of the reactor, you pay for the decommissioning of the reactor, you pay for the storage of radioactive waste. And when the reactor's built, the utility gets hold of it and makes $1 million a day selling you electricity for things that you don't need, like electric carving knives and clothes dryers and stuff like that. And it's interesting because you can extrapolate that to the Pentagon, which is a socialized industry too, and you spend $1 trillion a year of your tax money on weapons and on killing.
It's just unbearable as an American. I cannot stand that.
Killing.
We have another break upon us. We'll be right back.
Socialist agenda.
Welcome back to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler, along with my co-host.
Charlotte Littlefield, and a warm welcome back to the very accomplished Dr. Helen Caldicott. Doctor, you have such an extensive background of activism and education. It would be nearly impossible. It would take an hour just to tell our listening audience just how much you've done in the past 40 years or so of your career. I was wondering if you would mind talking a little bit about the Women's Action for Nuclear Disarmament, or what is now called Women's Action for New Directions.
Yes, I started that in 1980 or thereabouts, 1979, because so often when I gave a lecture, the women would come up and be terribly motivated. I'd talk about the medical effects of nuclear war. And men would come up and the man would say, look, you're not right, it's 357 cruise missiles, not 356. And the women would scream at the man and say, that's the sort of thinking that's going to kill us all. And I thought, women are 53% of the population, and we really have the power. And I actually started a new political party called the Women's Party for Survival so that we could eradicate nuclear weapons. And then people told me I was naive to think I could start a political party in America, and I wish I actually had gone along with that. So then we called it the Women's Action for Nuclear Disarmament, and we've become very powerful, and my goal was to get 50% of the people in Congress to be women by the year 2000, which didn't happen, of course. And the representation of women is still not very high in Congress, which is very bad. But I think we've been effective in many ways, educating women and encouraging them to run for office.
You know, yes, Doctor, I have what I call the man problem that I've looked at and written extensively. Men are the big problem. You know that.
I do know that, and I'm going to write a book called Why Men Kill and Why Women Let Them, because
in some of your speeches and everything else and the thrust of your whole being, well, women are our life givers and nurturers, and men are very detached and egotistical, maniacal idiots at times, are they not?
Yeah, they're strange creatures, I find. I mean, they're capable of great love and tenderness and the like when they fall in love, or when their children are dying or whatever, but they are strange creatures to agree. I don't really understand them on the whole. I think there's been a lot of work done lately on hormone receptors in the brain and how that influences human behavior. For instance, testosterone makes people very aggressive, and if you give testosterone to women, for instance, if they have breast cancer or whatever, they become aggressive too, and their sex drive goes up, which is interesting. And there's another hormone that women secrete at a time of stress called oxytocin, which is a very nurturing hormone, and that's secreted particularly after women give birth. And I remember when I had my three babies, I felt I could feed the whole world. I felt so nurturing. And so there's a very big physiological and behavioral difference between men and women. And I want to explore that because I find that fascinating. I know that this is a contentious subject. My audiences get quite disturbed when I talk about it, but it's very important to analyze and diagnose why we keep fighting and killing. And if we keep fighting and killing each other the way we always have, we're going to blow up the planet now that we've got nuclear weapons. There's absolutely no doubt about that.
Well, what I say, Doctor, sometimes is that we have false selves as generals, American generals, fighting other false selves in the guise of being Taliban fighters. See what I mean?
Yeah, that's
and
right.
These false selves are ego-based and nurtured, and the abstracted self then, well, within men, they can attain a higher level or a deeper delusional level of an abstraction of that false self. See what I mean?
Yes, I do. I think it was put best by one general who said, quote, unquote, if you take away our nuclear weapons, man, that's taking away the family jewel.
Yes, yes. Well,
so
young
that's
men.
That's why I called one of my books in 1984 Missile Engineer Freud, you know, because these weapons, I think, you know, they must have erectile dysfunction or something like that.
Right. Well, well, I believe in a delusional state. Men suffer a deeper delusional mode of existence than women do.
Oh, absolutely. I think.
And in that state, they're nurturing a false self through a lot more abstracted, conjured up, invented, and imagined ways to nurture that false self, and then that false self is tied to all these other false selves, and then that's the downfall of men in the world.
Well, you're probably right, and the fact is that we cohabit the planet with 30 million other species, all of whom are absolutely as important as are we, and we don't give credence to them at all. Our lives depend upon them, but our lives are less important than theirs. You know, koalas and kangaroos and wallabies and wombats and all the wonderful things we have in Australia, that will go too if we have a nuclear war. It just sickens
right.
me. It makes my heart weep.
Right.
They can
what
go
would you
with
say,
a nuclear
Charlotte?
Accident as they can go with a nuclear accident as well. I feel extremely vulnerable for the number of submarines that are out in the oceans, for the number of nuclear power plants providing, you know, electricity for communities. I feel very vulnerable even outside of whether somebody will drop a bomb or not.
Yes, you're right. America's got 104 nuclear power plants. They produce 20% of the electricity you use, and Americans waste 28% of the electricity they use. So, therefore, nuclear power is absolutely unnecessary, as it is in Japan, because now all their 54 reactors are closed down and they're doing all right. You know, they may be sweating a bit more in the summer because they can't run their air conditioners. Well, that's too bad. But you've got, I think, 21 reactors of the same design as Fukushima. Many of them are very vulnerable. Four are built on earthquake faults in California. I think that the Indian Point reactor is 35 miles from Manhattan near an earthquake fault. North Anna reactor near Washington, D.C., there was an earthquake near that recently and shook the reactor. So you are in great jeopardy.
And let's not kid ourselves. The nuclear engineers or the nuclear field is primarily full of men. End of discussion.
Well, I have to say that I do a lot of tweeting these days, and I tell you, some men are being so incredibly rude to me. So rude. And they work for the nuclear industry. They said they did it. And it's more than rude. They're disgusting.
I experienced, Dr. Caldicott, in the military, United States Navy, I was an electrician. I graduated in the top 10% of my class. Those top 10% who graduated with me got to go on to the Navy's nuclear program so they could operate the nuclear submarines. And that type of mentality that I saw was that, like a Top Gun fighter pilot almost. It was a very exclusive boys club, old boys network. You know, supposedly they were all high IQ'd, et cetera. I've been personally offended by their arrogance, their lack of common sense from day one.
Really? Were you on a nuclear submarine too?
No, I fixed them. I did not get to go out. There are women, I think, now serving on board submarines as of the last decade. But, no, I got out before women were put onto the submarines. In fact, I'm under the impression, well, they certainly are on the New York, the aircraft carriers, the nuclear aircraft carriers. And
well,
I could be mistaken.
It's totally inappropriate for women to be in the military. It was Gloria Steinem who introduced women into the military, saying, you know, we need equal rights. But women aren't killers. I think it's kind of, and, you know, I think over 50% of them are either raped in the military or sexually abused because the way they train them.
Oh, yeah, not a fun ride, I'll tell you that much.
Okay, we've got to take a break here. We'll be right back. Thank you for being with us. Welcome back to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler, along with my co-host,
Charlotte Littlefield, and a warm welcome back to Dr. Helen Caldicott. Doctor, I'd like to let the listening audience know that you have written numerous publications, and you are also the author of 7 books. For brevity, I'm not going to name all of your books, except to let the listening audience know that your most recent book was a revised update of your book, If You Love This Planet. It came out in March 2009. So, folks, go to Amazon.com or Dr. Caldicott, where are your books available at?
Yes, if you go to my website, HelenCaldicott.com, you can order them from Amazon. That's the best thing, I think.
Okay, great. You've also been the subject of several films, 8 Minutes to Midnight, among, I'm not going to list them all, but ladies and gentlemen, if you go to our website and to Dr. Helen Caldicott's website, you can see that. And George and I always like to end on a positive note. We're in our last segment, and I was wondering if you would like to talk about your the Helen Caldicott Foundation, nuclearfreeplanet.org,
yes.
And Beyond Nuclear.
NuclearFreePlanet.org. Yeah, I started the Helen Caldicott Foundation a couple of years ago, and we've got a web page, NuclearFreePlanet.org, and I've got a Facebook, and I'm doing a lot of social media now, tweeting and Facebooking, because I want to get to the younger generation, and they don't tend to read newspapers anymore, and they don't tend to watch the evening news or television. They're tweeting and they're on their Facebook. So I did that and it's becoming pretty successful. We're getting lots and lots and lots of visits all the time, particularly after Fukushima, because every time I open my computer, I would get 500 new downloads. What am I going to do? Where will I live? What do I feed my baby? How do I protect my children? People are desperate to know, and I think that's still so. I also have a radio program called If You Love This Planet, and it plays on the Pacifica Network, community stations around America, Canada, and Australia, and I interviewed the top people, leading scientists, on nuclear power, on radiation, on cancer, on cell phones and brain cancers, on global warming, sea level rises, permafrost melting, on nuclear war and the threat of nuclear war, which is really ever-present every day, with weapons on hair trigger alert, as you know, having worked in the Navy and knowing about those nuclear weapons. So if you go to ifyoulovethisplanet.org, you can listen to those programs, which are very popular, I have to say, particularly the ones about Fukushima.
Yeah, Dr. Caldicott, we have your full bio. I put it in our webpage program guide there. TheSecretTruth.com, and they can click off on your radio program, your publications, your foundations, and everything else. In your closing comments here, if we skipped over or left something out, summarize and give us some of your closing comments could be good advice to our listening audience.
Well, the three problems facing the planet, the major ones, as I see it as a physician practicing global preventive medicine, are one, global warming, and we can fix global warming. And in fact, I produced a report or commissioned a report called Carbon Free, Nuclear Free. By 2030, America could be carbon free and no nuclear power using renewable energy. There should be a solar panel on every house in America, solar hot water systems, solar generated cars, you know, solar panels on the parking lots. There's enough wind west of the Mississippi to supply the country with 3 times the electricity you currently use. The answer to global warming is there. Look it up. It's on my webpage, Carbon Free, Nuclear Free. It's a prescription for survival, number one. Number two, we must close down all the nuclear power plants in America tomorrow. And, you know, you are responsible for doing that. I think you should occupy the NRC. Whatever it takes, do it. Number three, we can abolish nuclear weapons. Russia wants to. Of the 23,000 hydrogen bombs in the world today, Russia and America own 97%. They're the real rogue states holding the world at nuclear ransom every second of every day when there could be an accidental nuclear war. So, therefore, if Russia wants to abolish the weapons and the Pentagon's holding it up, you have to get off your bottom, so to speak, and get out there and make sure that the American politicians are responsible to save the planet. And we can't abolish nuclear weapons. If Russia and America abolish theirs together, then we can say to France, okay, you get rid of yours. To England, you get rid of yours. To Israel, which has the third largest nuclear arsenal in the world, you get rid of yours too. India and Pakistan. So what I'm optimistic about is there are solutions to the three major problems facing the planet: global warming, nuclear power, and nuclear war. Educate yourself. I would quote President Jefferson, an informed democracy will behave in a responsible fashion. Inform yourself. Read the books I wrote. I don't need to make money. I didn't write them for money. I wrote them for education. Read them like I read Grey's Anatomy to become a physician, and know that because the Earth is in the intensive care unit, acutely, critically ill, we are all now physicians to a dying planet, and we can save it.
Well, I tell you what, it's getting very, very dangerous, isn't it?
Yes. Yes, it is. And we must be informed, and we must stop practicing psychic numbing and face reality, go through the grief process, and then decide to do something about it. I mean, if you love your children, if you love your grandchildren, if you love smelling a rose when the roses start blooming, you'll know what I'm talking about.
As far as protecting ourselves from Fukushima, can things like changing our diet to protect the thyroid?
No, there's nothing you can do. Except that if you know that there's going to be a meltdown in a reactor near you, you can take potassium iodide tablets before you breathe in the radioactive iodine in the radioactive cloud that blocks the uptake of radioactive iodine in your thyroid gland. But there are 200 other isotopes, as you mentioned, which go to all sorts of organs in your body, and that won't stop cancers developing in various parts of your body. No, the answer is there's nothing you can do. That's a tragedy. That's the diabolical drama of nuclear power. There's nothing we as physicians can do to protect you or save you once a nuclear accident has occurred and you've been irradiated or you eat radioactive food. Do not eat any food from Japan. Hillary Clinton signed a deal with Japan saying that America would still import food from Japan as normal.
So you believe that there's a cover-up on the dangers that are occurring right now in Fukushima?
I don't believe there's a cover-up. There is a major cover-up in your media, a major, wicked, immoral cover-up, something that we've never seen in the history of medicine before, because this is a medical problem. It's a medical problem.
So that's what we started out reporting this within days of the night of the accident over there. We were getting reports that within 24, 48 hours, there were meltdown, there were isotopes and particles being released that would indicate meltdown underway. We were on top of this, but the press and the Air Force, we interviewed Air Force personnel. They were all in to put a cap on it and keep it down, keep it quiet, moderate their view. That's what we saw.
It's really wicked. I can't think of any other word but wicked. Just wicked.
Right. It's wicked, that's for sure.
Well, on a positive note, the civilians of the United States have started a sort of semi-professional, we can't even call it professional, but these are amateur radiological workers who are trying to test. It's a voluntary system. It's nationwide where they're measuring background radiation. Because we know the government's not doing
it. With Geiger counters, but you're only measuring gamma radiation, which doesn't tell you what the isotopes are. Some isotopes from reactors give off gamma radiation, and some do not. Some, like tritium, only produce beta radiation, which is not measured with a Geiger counter. Some, like plutonium and others, only give out alpha radiation, which is not measured by a Geiger counter.
Absolutely.
So
the learning curve is steep, and anyways, we can conquer this, like you were saying. We have tough challenges, but we can do this.
Dr. Helen Caldicott, we certainly admire all your hard work, We're getting ready to exit here in about 30 seconds, but thank you for taking the time to being on our program, and we certainly do honor you tonight and all your past work and your brilliant types of approach this year.
Thank you very much. It's my great pleasure to be with you, and I admire you too for what you do. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. Good night.
Bye-bye.